All right, today we're going to be looking at the parable of the 10 minas. And when we read this parable, it's easy to link this parable to a similar parable in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. In Matthew 25, Jesus speaks in terms of these talents rather than minas or minas. And a talent is a weight of measurement, right? It's a measurement of weight for the value of something, for the glory of something. And here Jesus uses a different measuring amount, a mina. And it's easy for us to conflate the two parables into one, but this telling that Jesus offers is a little bit different, and we should notice the differences. Unlike in the parable of the talents, in Matthew 25, verses 14 to 30, Jesus is not yet in Jerusalem. Jesus and his disciples are on their way from Galilee to Jerusalem, and now they're in Jericho in Luke's gospel. And as he draws closer to Jerusalem, the urgency of his teaching flows from the reality that he is about to accomplish his mission, and he will not be with them much longer. Jesus is seeking to prepare his disciples for their ministry following his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. The events in Luke 19 that actually happened before and this parable are related. They're connected. He has just healed blind Bartimaeus, right, who has been crying out, "Son of David, have mercy on me, Son of David, have mercy on me." And now he has entered into the house of a very wealthy tax collector named Zacchaeus. And the response of those who are watching Jesus and watching him is this. In Luke 19, verse 7 to 10, we read, "And when they saw it, they all grumbled, 'He has gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner.'" Now the question for us as we're looking at this passage is, what is the fruit that is born in the life of this sinner by the mercy of Jesus? Zacchaeus stood, we read, and he said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of all my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will restore it fourfold." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." Now the question for us is, what is the compounding interest or the margin of profit or the return on the mercy of God? Right? The mercy of one who loves those who are sinners, right? What is the return on that which has been given or demonstrated or shown? Now, a significant clue to how it is that we can understand and interpret the parable comes in Luke's initial comment as to why Jesus told the parable to his disciples in the first place. We read in verse 11 that the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. Now, the kingdom of God is coming in the next week. But what's going to help his disciples understand as they work through that week and all of what it is that's going to transpire? And consequently, how are they going to live that life after his death, his burial, his resurrection, and his ascension, right? How are they going to live life in between his two comings? And as we look at Luke 19, verses 11 to 28, we're going to be looking at what happens in the parable, trying to get our head around that. Secondly, what does the passage have to say about faith in the kingdom of God, and then what comes next? David Collins is going to come forward and read our passage.
Good morning. Our sermon text is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19, verses 11 through 28. "As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable, because he was near to Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, A nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and in return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your minas has made 10 minas more. And he said to them, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your minas has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your minas, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit, and you reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Well then, you did not put my money in the bank, and at my coming I may have collected it with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the minas from him and give it to the one who has the 10 minas. And he said to him, Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given, but from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. For as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. And when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you, David. All right, so what's going on in this parable? Firstly, we read that a man of noble birth went to a distant country in order to be made king. Now, in an empire like the Roman Empire, no king gets to be a king until the King of Kings says that you get to be the king. Upon leaving, this king commands his servants to put his money to work. And the would-be king gives his stewards money to be invested and to be used as he himself would use it. Right? You put my money to work while I'm gone. Now, the scenario that Jesus is talking about and using about a king going to a foreign country to be made a king mirrors a well-known event that would have resonated with the hearers who were listening to Jesus tell this parable. It would be like me saying, you know, I've decided that I'm going to run for president. And I'm going to run as a third-party candidate in order to stop the giant sucking sound caused by NAFTA. Now, maybe for some of you that just was like, what, you know? But for others of you, you can hear me saying, it's a loud sucking sound, right? You can hear it just like that because that was Ross Perot in 1996 as he was running for president. Right, it would have connected. As Jesus is telling this parable, the same sort of thing would have happened. Why is that? Well, because of events that had happened 30 years earlier. They were familiar to them. It was familiar to them in their regional history. The king who followed Herod the Great was his son Herod Archelaus. And he was the kind of king that Jesus is describing in this parable. His becoming king mirrors the events that Jesus uses in his parable, and it would jog their memories, and they would begin to kind of listen, right? They would connect with it. When Jesus says that a delegation went to oppose the king's appointment, many would have recalled that the very same thing happened when King Archelaus, Herod Archelaus, went to Rome to be made king over Judea by Caesar Augustus. They would have known that King Herod the Great himself died in the city of Jericho, right? And that Herod Archelaus, who was ethnarch and king over 9 years, right, for 9 years after King Herod, was known for his cruelty. In fact, he was so disliked by his contemporaries that a delegation went to Caesar Augustus to oppose his being made king. Now, Augustus did make King Herod Archelaus the king over Judea. And do you know what King Archelaus did when he came back after having been opposed by a delegation? He had 3,000 Judeans killed. It's because of Archelaus's cruelty that the angel warns Joseph not to return to Bethlehem on their way back from Egypt when he is born, right? And so Jesus, right, is taken by Joseph and Mary up to Nazareth instead. Now the question that's in the disciples' mind is, what's going to happen when this king, son of David, the bringer of the kingdom of God, arrives in Jerusalem to be crowned king? What's that going to look like? What kind of reckoning is going to take place? Who is going to die when that happens? Right, so you see, Jesus is telling this parable, and he's talking to them, but he's telling it on the slant. That is, he's not telling them what's going to happen next week, right? Over the course of the next week, he is contrasting it with what they imagine is going to happen. And then consequently, what it is that they will in fact witness. Returning to the parable, we learn that the king returns and he orders his ten servants to appear before him and to give an account of their business dealings on his behalf. We learn that the first and the second have done well. The first, right, tells the king, "Sir, your mine has earned 10 more," to which the king responds, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And his master replied, "Because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter," a mina is about kind of 3 months' wages, right? "You're going to take charge over 10 cities." And the second servant comes to his master, "Sir, your mina has earned 5 more," to which the king responds, "Take yours," right, "take charge of 5 cities." And then a third servant comes, and he says, "Sir, your mina I've kept laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man, you're a severe man." The word there, I think, is only used in the New Testament once, and it's the word we get austere from. "Because you're a severe man, a hard man. You take out what you did not reap, put in, and you reap what you did not sow." And to this, his master replied, "I will judge you by your own words," which is to say that if you really believed that I was a severe, hard man, you would have done better because you would have put my money on deposit so that when I came back, I could have collected it with interest. If you really believed that, you would have done better. But then the king does the unexpected. He says to those standing by, "Take his mina away and give it to the one who has 10. Now, note this. Nothing more is said about that servant, right? The servant who hid his in the cloth. The parable of the talents, right? In the parable of the talents, the faithless servant, this is in Matthew 25, the faithless servant is cast out into outer darkness, we hear Jesus say. But here, the focus seems to be on the remaining 7 servants. The ones who are observing what it is that has happened and how the king has judged. And what's their response? They are shocked. "Sir, he already has 10. Do you get the outrage? Do you resonate with that sense of injustice? I mean, he was successful, right? His success has been doubled. Not only that, right, he's basically been made a prince if he's given charge over 10 cities. But the newly crowned king explains, "I tell you that to everyone who has more will be given, but as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away." Isn't that good news? It's just confounding, right? It's just troubling. We're meant to trip over it. Right, as we consider the fate of the third servant, we should note that this servant has not stolen or lost the mina. He simply has not done anything with it. Secondly, we need to note that the king takes the servant's one mina and gives it to the servant who has the most. What do you make of that? And lastly, the king does what is not unexpected. Got that? He does what is not unexpected. And what is that? But those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me. Now, there are several ways to unpack that judgment. It can mirror the last judgment, the final judgment, when all debts are settled. It can also foreshadow the coming judgment that's going to come to Jerusalem, as they have rejected, as they will reject their king, and what will happen. But it also can be used to describe or to be contrasted with what is going to happen over the next week. Jesus is going to enter Jerusalem amidst a throng who gladly receive him. And in a week, a delegation will go to Rome's governor over that, right? The Rome's governor over Judea and oppose this king. And what is it that they're going to ask be done to him? Okay, so that's all of what's going on in the parable. What does the passage have to say to us about living our life in the midst or in between Jesus' two comings? How do we live by faith, right? And what do we learn about the kingdom of God? Well, firstly, salvation has come. That's the first thing. We hear that in the story of Zacchaeus, right? These themes actually have been building through Luke's gospel since chapter 15. Seeking, finding, grumbling, giving, waiting. They're continuing here. Salvation has come to Zacchaeus' house. Not merely because Jesus has come to his house, which isn't insignificant, but salvation is realized in how it is that Zacchaeus responds to that. How Zacchaeus responds to the saving one who has come to his house. Right? Zacchaeus is one who knows that he was lost and has been found. He's living in the midst of the wonder and the joy of that. Jesus is one who is seeking the lost. He's making friends with sinners. The Pharisees are standing up to the side and they're grumbling. The response to finding, we've been told over and over again, should be rejoicing. Salvation has come to Zacchaeus' house, not because he's earned that favor, but because salvation has had its proper effect in his life. He gives half his goods to the poor and promises to restore those whom he's defrauded fourfold. Right? Those acts are not the cause of the salvation that's come to his house. They are the overflow of the fact that salvation has come to his house. Salvation has come and it is a treasure. But the people, right? They're all kind of caught up with this rising tension. Jesus has been coming from Galilee to Jerusalem. He's now in Jericho. This is the launching point, it seems. And the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. This is the end, they thought. But it's not. It's not going to come all at once. That king, this king, the son of David, is going to go away, but he will return. He is going to go away and be made king. When he returns, what will he find his servants doing or having done since he's been gone? So that's the first thing. Salvation has come. And we need to be, secondly, faithful. Right? We have been entrusted with something that is valuable to our master, and we must be faithful to do with it as he would do. The question for us is, what has Jesus entrusted to us? Right? It seems that his third servant, though he says he's a hard man, that this third servant wouldn't have been rebuked if he had merely just deposited the minas in a bank. You and I, we are commanded to step out and be faithful, whether we have a little bit or a lot. We're commanded to invest and seek to grow the wealth of our nobleman's riches. The work that we're engaged in is a long play. We have to be patient. We have to plan. We have to invest. We have to see things grow, not unlike tending a fig tree that has been found to be fruitless that we read about in Luke 13. It doesn't need chopping down. The soil around it needs tilling up and fertilizing. We need to get our hands dirty. Again, right, what is the son of David's wealth? What is it that blind Bartimaeus received from this king? What is it that Zacchaeus received from the king? Right, what is the wealth of this king who has come to Jericho? It is his salvation and his mercy. Right? His graciousness, his generosity, his love, his abounding loving kindness. Jesus didn't give Zacchaeus any money. What did he give? What did Jesus give Zacchaeus? The blessing of his presence and fellowship with him, his friendship and love. What could Zacchaeus do for Jesus? He could invest that mercy, that graciousness, that generosity, that loving kindness in others. He could pay that blessing forward. That's the life of faith that we're living. And faithfulness has integrity, because the one who is faithful all the way down. Well done, verse 17, my good servant, his master replied, because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities, of a great matter. Faithfulness in all things is what is being encouraged here. Right? We're not faithful with a little so that we can get a lot. Right? Some of us imagine that we would be faithful with a lot, but we're faithless with the little. Right? The integrity is one that goes all the way down. It goes all the way to the heart. It is all through and through. Now, Peter has had his name changed, right? Up to this point. His new name, right, went from Simon to Cephas, or to Peter. Right? His name means rock. But Peter's faithfulness is going to be rocked. James and John, next couple passages, are going to want to be on Jesus' right and left. But they are going to be left right behind as Jesus shows them the glory that he has come to receive and the glory of his crown that he will receive. Thomas, while they were still in Galilee, he advocated that all of them go with Jesus to Jerusalem so that, he says, we might die with him. But he isn't even going to be present on Easter evening when Jesus first appears to all of the disciples. Faithfulness is not sometimes faithful and sometimes not. Faithfulness is faithful whether in big things or in small things. That's what we're being challenged to and called to. Fourthly, grace is the name of the game. Grace is the name of the game. What do you call verse 19, right? Take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow. That doesn't sound like justice, does it? For those who are grumbling that Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners, this is just unjust or severe. Right? It's capricious. But for the one who is on the receiving end of getting more than what they had put in, to one who goes out and who harvests and gathers in more than they had sowed, What is that? To them, it is miraculous. It is wonderful. It is cause for great rejoicing. You just go, how lucky am I? It's wonderful. What else would you call being given more than you deserve? Having 10 and getting 10 more. Jesus is challenging his disciples to consider, like, if you spend mercy, if you are one who shows mercy, are you going to be left out of mercy? If you are one who shows mercy, will you be, you're spending the capital of your energy and your resources in order to show and extend that forbearing, that mercy, is it going to just have diminishing returns? Are you just going to be left empty-handed with nothing? No, Jesus says, you will get more. Mercy is, it's called back compounding interest as being one of the wonders of the world, right? Right? Well, mercy here is the promise that it's going to last forever. And what you invest in mercy in this life is not something that you're going to go, well, you know, I bought it at this and then it just kind of tanked and, you know, I lost all my money. That's not going to be the case with mercy. And how do we know this? Because more will be given. I tell you, to everyone who has mercy, more will be given. But for the one who has no mercy, even what they have will be taken away. Right? If having been shown mercy and the loving kindness of the faithful King, you will not show mercy, do you think that you're going to be shown mercy? But if you make use of the King's mercy by spending it on others, investing it in others, seeking and rejoicing over the lost who are found, do you think the King is going to return and punish you for wasting it? What's going to happen? We read in verse 28 that Jesus had said this, and he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. Today, right, we're remembering Palm Sunday. Jesus will do what is expected. He will fulfill prophecy. He will enter on a donkey's colt. And as Zechariah 9:9 says, right, the people rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, on the foal of a donkey. And he will do the unexpected. Judas Iscariot, he will consider his master's treasure worth 30 pieces of silver. For the crowd, his life is worth the life of Barabbas. For Pilate, his death is worth the peace of the crowd that is gathered in Jerusalem at that Passover. For the Sadducees and for the high priest, he's worth maintaining the status quo. The king will be rejected. He will be rejected by his people, and he will die for his fearful, faithless subjects. The question for us is, what will we do with the forgiveness and mercy and love that our King shares with us today? Will you hide it? Or will you invest it in others?